Today at Reader's Corner, Melanie Kirkpatrick, author of Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad.
North Korea has a long history of bellicose rhetoric, but Kim Jong-un seems to have taken it to a higher level than usual. I do not support giving aid to North Korea. I think that has propped up the regime, and in a way, it's helped facilitate the situation that we find ourselves in right now. More and more North Koreans are escaping, and they're doing so with the help of both human traffickers and also Christian missionaries and other humanitarian workers.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. North Korea has long been the most isolated nation on Earth. It is illegal to enter or leave without special permission from the ruling regime. And everything from mail service and cell phones to the internet, radio, and television are under tight state control. North Koreans know little about the world outside of their own, but that's changing. Hunger and deplorable conditions are forcing many to attempt escape. And new communications to and from North Korea holds promise for change. In her book, Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad, author Melanie Kirkpatrick takes us on a journey inside North Korea and China and familiarizes us with a new network of safe houses and humanitarians that are fostering this information revolution. Ms. Kirkpatrick is a writer and senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. She had a long career at the Wall Street Journal, where her jobs included running the op-ed page, editing the editorials, and serving as deputy editor of the editorial page. She grew up in Buffalo, attended Princeton University, and has lived in Toronto, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Manhattan. She now lives in rural Connecticut. Ms. Kirkpatrick joins us by phone for this interview. Melanie Kirkpatrick, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, Melanie, we're going to get to your book in a second, but I can't miss this opportunity. In these last few weeks, there's been this flare-up of tensions between North Korea and South Korea, North Korea, the United States, and then there's news as late as yesterday that they may have been moving some missiles to one of the coasts, and it's pretty scary stuff, and I just wondered from your perspective and your knowledge of the region, any thoughts or comments on where this thing goes? What's the Department of Defense doing this morning as they try to figure this out?
Well, you are correct in saying that it's scary stuff. North Korea has a long history of bellicose rhetoric, but Kim Jong-un, the young new leader in recent weeks, seems to have taken it to a higher decibel level than usual. It's a dangerous situation, and while I think it will probably play out okay, there are no assurances of that, and the United States and the rest of the world is right to take things very seriously and prepare for the worst. You know, North Korea does have a nuclear capability, which is very scary, and I think the lesson of North Korea applies very importantly to Iran, which is that once a country has nuclear weapons, it's much more difficult to deal with it, and we should not let Iran go nuclear. So, you know, right now it's also important to remember that North Korea, besides its nuclear weapons, also has a very significant capability in conventional weapons. It has a lot of artillery relayed along the border with South Korea, and the capital of Seoul is only 25 miles away from that border. North Korea would be able to put very significant damage in South Korea if it were so inclined. It also has chemical weapons, which is another danger. So it all adds up to a scary situation. In the past, North Korea backs down after this bellicose rhetoric, and it's, you know, let's hope that it will back down in the weeks to come. There are two things that are coming up that might give it an occasion to back down. One is April 15th is the birthday of Kim Il-sung, the founder and eternal president of North Korea. And the rhetoric often gets ratcheted up around that time and then dissipates afterwards. And also the American and South Korean military, joint military exercises will end in a couple of weeks. And that could also give North Korea an opportunity to back down on its rhetoric.
Well, and some of this saber rattling has been attributed to the fact that whenever North Korea's economy really goes into the shambles, and of course it's there right now, as a way of getting aid, it starts its saber rattling. And in the past, the United States has responded accordingly. And you do have to wonder whether it's such a great policy for us just to throw aid their way every time they saber rattle.
I do not support giving aid to North Korea. I think that has propped up the regime, and in a way it's helped facilitate the situation that we find ourselves in right now. I think our policy should be regime change, and that would mean not giving aid that we know doesn't get to the people to whom it's intended. A number of international aid organizations have pulled out of North Korea for that reason. It knows that its aid does not go to the needy, but instead goes to the North Korean elite and to the military. Mm-hmm. I'd also point out that perhaps there's something else going on as well this time around, which is that Kim Jong-un has been in power a little bit over a year. He took over when his father, Kim Jong-il, died in December of 2011. And he's still consolidating his power. We don't know a whole lot about the power structure in North Korea, but it's very likely that a lot of his actions are aimed internally as well as externally.
Well, there is one way that the people of North Korea can be supported, and that, of course, is the Underground Railroad that you write about in your book. It's an incredible story of heroism and courage and humanitarianism, and I wonder if you could just start by helping us understand the nature of the Underground Railroad, what that means.
Sure. Let me begin by saying that the people of North Korea often get forgotten as we talk about North Korea's nuclear program, its missile prowess, and the loony antics of the North Korean dictators. And yet something very profound, I believe, is happening, and that is that in recent years, the past decade or so, more and more North Koreans are escaping. And they're doing so with the help of both human traffickers who are paid for their work, and also Christian missionaries and other humanitarian workers, most of whom are located in China. And what they do is they help North Koreans who reach China to escape from China across the country, usually to Southeast Asia, and then eventually on to South Korea, where they are granted sanctuary. And this route is referred to as by a lot of the workers as an underground railroad. And they compare it to what happened in our country in the lead-up to the Civil War, where slaves were escaping from bondage in the South, going to the North, and then on to Canada. And it works in a very similar way. That is, there are safe houses across the country. The routes vary. There are people who work in isolation helping North Koreans get out. Nobody except maybe the top guy who's running his particular escape knows every piece of this puzzle. And for operational security, individuals don't know everybody who is helping North Koreans, so that if one person gets caught, not everybody will go to jail. China does not welcome North Koreans. Its policy is to track them down, arrest them, and send them back to North Korea. China also has a policy of arresting people who help North Koreans in China. There are Americans and South Koreans who have gone to jail for the so-called crime of giving a North Korean a meal or helping them get out of China.
Haven't people been kidnapped in China by the North Koreans and taken back? Or maybe it was by the Chinese, but I know there were some, you detailed in your book, some kidnappings where people were actually removed from China after.
China permits North Korean agents to operate on Chinese soil.
Yeah.
And one of the examples I give in Escape from North Korea is of a pastor by the name of Pastor Kim, I believe, who was working in China, running a safe house for North Koreans who arrived there. And Pastor Kim was a resident of the United States. He was supported by a church in Illinois. His children are American citizens. Pastor Kim himself had a green card. And one day he was tricked into going to a restaurant with a couple of people, North Koreans, who turned out to be agents of the state. They grabbed him, put him into the back of a car, and took him over to North Korea, where he disappeared. It turned out that he had been sent to prison and apparently died there. We know all of this because a North Korean who was part of this kidnapping operation eventually decided he wanted to escape too, and he made his way to South Korea, where he actually ended up being arrested, and in the court case that followed, a lot of these details came out.
By the way, I should point out to our listeners that in the back of your book, you have a section called How to Help, and there's a number of these organizations listed, and once you read this book, you really do want to get your checkbook out and write something to these organizations that are doing this incredible work. These are all not-for-profits. Many of them are religious organizations, and they need some help. And again, people who read the book can find the directive on how to do that. In the meantime, we're talking to Melanie Kirkpatrick. She's the author of Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. Well, speaking of the Christian organizations, you point out in your book that when a North Korean reaches China, the first thing you want to do is find a Christian. So help us with how these Christian non-for-profits, the churches in many cases, the Presbyterian Church, I guess, was long active in North and South Korea, how they have come to be the key players here in this.
Well, let me explain what happens when a North Korean decides he wants to leave North Korea. It is very difficult to get official permission to do so. So he can't go south to South Korea directly because of the demilitarized zone that separates the two countries. And the DMZ is kind of a contradiction in terms because it is actually the world's most militarized border. There are a million mines there, and it's next to impossible for a North Korean to escape through the DMZ. But the vast majority of North Koreans who want to escape go to China, and they have to cross a river to get there. So they swim across, they wade across. In the winter, they walk across the frozen river. And once they hit China, a lot of them have no plan. They just know they want to find food or they want to find work. In some cases, they want to find a relative who may be there. And they literally start knocking on doors, asking for help. If they're lucky, somebody will direct them to a church or to a Christian who will be willing to help them. As I mentioned earlier, it's against the law in China to give help to any North Korean. So a lot of people are reluctant to do so. There are a lot of bad guys involved in all of this as well, particularly if it involves a young woman. Because of China's longstanding one-child policy, there is a very severe shortage of marriageable-age young women in China. And in that part of China bordering North Korea, the ratio of young men to young women is, in parts of that area, as high as 14 to 1. So the one thing that a young man wants most in life, in many cases, is a bride, and he will try to get one from North Korea. That is, he will try to buy one from North Korea. And there are brokers who have scouts on the border so that when an attractive young woman makes it across the river to China, they will pretend to help her, but in fact they will call one of their broker contacts who will then come, take her, and sell her to a man who wants a bride. Of course, the young woman has no recourse because if she asks for help from the police, the Chinese police, she'll be arrested and sent back to North Korea, which in her mind is a fate worse than being sold to a Chinese husband. But as I mentioned, the lucky ones, as you pointed out, the lucky ones find Christians. And there was a wonderful story of a boy I interviewed who had crossed the river to North Korea, and he started knocking on doors, asking for help, and finally one man let him in and gave him a meal, and then as the boy was going on his way, the man suggested that he go to this certain town, and an elderly woman he met there told him to look for a church, and he said, well, what's a church? And the woman said, look for a building with a cross on it. And I've heard that story from a number of North Korean refugees in China. They'll say the church people would often provide meals, sometimes a place to stay, and if they trusted the North Korean, they might put him in touch with somebody who could direct him to the Underground Railroad and a route out of China to South Korea.
So what happens to the children born of a Chinese man and a North Korean woman who was kidnapped and placed in the hands of this gentleman? That wouldn't be the word, but anyway.
They often find themselves in a very sad situation. The children of Chinese men are entitled to Chinese citizenship, but in order to claim the benefits of that citizenship, the children must be registered with the government, and Chinese husbands are reluctant to do that, in part because if they register the existence of their children, then they have to reveal the existence of their North Korean wife, or North Korean unofficial wife, I should say, and that puts her in danger. So as a result, many of these kids are not registered, and that means that they can't go to school, and they can't get medical care, and they're growing up in a very bad situation. So a number of Christian missionaries from the United States and South Korea are focusing their efforts on trying to help these kids. They'll set up unofficial orphanages for them, where, you know, kind of like foster homes where they can take care of them. They'll come up with the money to buy them fake IDs or come up with the money to bribe Chinese officials to allow the fathers to register them late. In other words, they're trying to help these kids in place in China. A number of these kids have lost their mothers because their mothers have either been arrested and sent back to North Korea, or in some cases the mothers have decided to escape to South Korea on the Underground Railroad. When the mother is sent back to North Korea, her children don't go with her. The kids are sometimes literally ripped from their mother's arms. The reason for this is that North Korea will not accept the children of Chinese men and North Korean women. North Koreans are very racist, and they believe that the Chinese blood is a pollutant. And any woman who is sent back to North Korea and is found to be pregnant is forced to abort her baby. And I've heard just very gruesome stories about how that happens.
Now, the ones who make it, that is, the ones who get over to China and then wind their way through China, tell us about the route of that railroad, because it's not as simple as just doubling back to South Korea in all cases. In some cases, there's countries at the other end of China that they escape to and then make their decisions on where they want to eventually wind up.
Yes, a North Korean really has to make two escapes, one from North Korea and a second one from China. And the second escape, usually, the Underground Railroad usually takes him to Southeast Asia these days, thousands of miles across China from the border with North Korea to Southeast Asia, often to Burma or Vietnam or Laos, all of which border China in the area known as the Golden Triangle, where there historically has been a lot of drug trafficking, and now there is human trafficking. And once in one of those countries, many of them go on to a place like Cambodia or Thailand. But in every case, what the North Korean will do is find his way to a South Korean embassy or a South Korean consular facility and ask for help. And under South Korea's constitution, every North Korean is entitled to live in South Korea if he wishes to. Now, that makes it sound a lot easier than it really is. North Koreans often face a hard time in any of those Southeast Asian countries that I mentioned before they eventually reach safety. And it can take a long time. You know, for example, they've entered the Southeast Asian country illegally. So some of the countries will require that they spend some time in jail before they let them go to South Korea, or that they pay a fine before they'll let them go. But it's a measure of the desperation of the North Koreans who are trying to escape that they're willing to endure these kinds of hardships in order to reach safety in the South.
And these are multi-year journeys, aren't they? I mean, it's not like they're catching a train and zipping across thousands of miles of China in a few days or a week or so.
It can be multi-year. In recent years, the journey has sometimes been accelerated. And I know of cases of North Koreans who have managed to get out from North Korea to South Korea over just a few months. But until recently, many of the North Koreans often spent a couple of years or more, many years in China before they summoned the courage to leave China and were able to make the contacts to help them get out in the Underground Railroad. So yes, a lot of the North Koreans spend a long time in China before they leave. And think a minute about what that life is like. Because they are under constant threat of arrest, they have to go underground, and that means that they're often exploited if they find a job. Their employers, can always hold it over them that, say, hey, if you don't do this job for the pittance we're paying you, we'll turn you over to the police. Or, as I mentioned before, they find themselves sold as brides. Some of the women are forced to work in brothels or in the internet sex industry. So it's a very difficult life for a lot of the North Koreans who are hiding in China.
Today, my guest is Melanie Kirkpatrick. She's the author of Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. One of the things that just strikes me about this book is the incredible heroism, the humanitarianism that is in this book. And you have a half dozen people in here. Most of them are Korean by birth and heritage. And they just go on to take these incredible risks. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And I don't know where or which one you'd want to point out, but I really would like to make sure we have in this brief interview just a little vignette of somebody who fits this bill of a true Korean hero when it comes to coming to the aid and assistance of his people. Philip Buck comes to mind as one, and I think you identified him as perhaps one of the founders of the Underground Railroad, but give us an idea of one of these people who made a difference.
Let me give you two quick examples. Philip Buck is an American of Korean heritage. He is a pastor in Seattle, and he has devoted a number of years now to helping North Koreans get out of China and reach safety in South Korea. He spent a couple of years in jail in China for his work, and after that he came back to the United States. And he's helping people still today, working from Seattle with his contacts in China and elsewhere. But I'd also like to mention a North Korean, if I may. I interviewed many, many North Koreans whose stories I tell in my book. And one of them was a military officer who escaped and eventually made his way to South Korea. And there, what did he do? He decided that he wanted to help his people. And he has started a radio station that broadcasts several hours a day to North Korea. And there are actually several radio stations run by North Koreans who've escaped in Seoul and broadcasting information into North Korea. It's a crime for a North Korean to listen to these radio broadcasts, but we know that a lot of people do. Based on interviews of North Koreans who have escaped to China, we know that a lot of North Koreans are listening to these radio broadcasts, even though if they're caught, the consequences can be severe. And a number of North Koreans who escape have set up not just radio stations, but also organizations whose purpose it is to get information back into North Korea educate their countrymen about the reality of the outside world, and also educate them about the reality of North Korea, countering the propaganda that they hear from their regime.
So these interviews that you did, Melanie, how do you protect these folks? Because, man, it's persecution there in the North anyway, and I'm sure you had to be very careful in assuring people that if they talked, you'd use other names, or what kind of... I mean, you got great information, so clearly you were able to get past this, but how?
Well, as I set about writing the book, I discovered that there were so many people I could have spoken to, but one group I focused on were people who had been rescued by rescuers that I had interviewed. And I discovered that with, you know, if a rescuer such as Pastor Philip Buck would introduce me to somebody he had helped, that North Korean was, because he was obligated to the person who had rescued him, would be more willing to talk to me. And also I felt more willing to tell the truth. Second, I would be able to try to, in some cases, verify the information by hearing stories from other people who were also on the same rescue mission or from the rescuer himself. I always would try to set the ground rules before we started. Very few people wanted me to use their real name, and certainly did not take photographs of them. But, you know, one thing I discovered in interviewing so many North Koreans was that North Koreans are very eager to get their information out. They want the world to know what North Korea is really like. That is one of the values that one of the things we've learned in the past 10 years is what the country is really like, and that's thanks to these people who've escaped. The second thing they're trying to do is get information back into North Korea, and I think that has the potential to have a big impact on North Korea. And if you could have grassroots pressure on the regime for change, as well as pressure from the outside world, all the better.
China is so much at the center of how this conflict gets resolved. Even the part about whether or not these folks will be treated well once they reach China. So I have to ask the question whether or not you think, does the United States even spend any time working with China on how it might loosen up some of these policies, allowing North Korean agents into China to track down these refugees, for example? Do we spend any time whatsoever at the highest levels of our government dealing with China on something like that, or is it all about economics?
I sure hope we do, and I understand that it is raised. Of course, this is all behind the scenes, but I understand that it's been raised. I'd like to see, of course, more pressure. A lot of this is behind the scenes, and I think a little more publicity on China's mistreatment of North Koreans is in order. And, you know, one of the things I point out in my book is how China is complicit in the mistreatment of North Koreans. Now, China's nowhere near as bad as the Kim family regime in North Korea, but by sending North Koreans back to North Korea, it is in itself guilty of a human rights obligation. And I also might add, it is not fulfilling its own obligations under international treaties it has signed, which require China to allow the United Nations to help refugees in its country. And yet China refuses to let the United Nations help or even interview North Koreans in China.
Melanie, thank you so much. Thanks for being on the show. Thanks for writing the book. This clearly is a must-read for anybody who cares about this world we live in. I really want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Again, it's Melanie Kirkpatrick, the author of the book Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. Next week, Candace Millard, author of Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.